is scientific apologetics session 4, and I'm going to remember to do this. All right.
I don't know if it's my hearing going bad, but I can stand the volume up a little.
Oh, higher?
Yeah.
Okay, we'll see. Could you do me a favor and see if there's a red dot up there?
Yes.
Okay, thanks. It's kind of a routine thing, so you're just going to have to get used to that. Sorry. I can't not do that. They will fire me, even though I don't work here. Just kidding. All right. So last week, we were in the middle of this whole chunk of thought related to naturalism, and we were talking about the reasons why naturalism ought to be rejected as a worldview or as a philosophy of science. And so scientism obviously is part or a related view to naturalism. So we talked about why scientism ought to be rejected and the limitations of science itself and the needs of science in terms of how the thought process of science is dependent on logic and things like that. Now, this week we're going to continue talking about why we should reject naturalism, and we'll do that in the first chunk until the break. And then after the break, we're going to talk about alternative views of science, and we're going to talk about good models of doing science for the secular person and for the Christian. And then we're hopefully, towards the end, going to get into looking at 4 different views of the relationship between science and religion, 4 different ways to view science and religion as in basically different fields of knowledge. And so that's kind of where we're at. And if you have your structure of your argument, of the argument that we're following, hopefully in the flap on the left-hand side of your folder there, you can see that we are still on the first premise, that scientism and naturalism are easily defeated and ought to be rejected, and we're partially down from there looking at item 4, that there are legitimate problems of naturalism and scientism. So that's kind of where we're at in terms of the flow of thought.
Remember what page was to pull out a different
flap? Yeah, I don't, but I'm going to look over here.
Okay.
32 of 33.
32.
And 33 of 33 of the first... I believe it was the first outline, the first packet. Hi. Okay, so right now we are going to where we left off last week in the handout, the last handout I gave you. And we are at page 17. And we're about 2/3 of the way down. And we're looking at, can naturalism successfully reduce the mind to the brain or show that the mind and the brain are identical? Now, before we start talking about the mind and the brain, and I've mentioned it in the past few classes, just happened to talk about it in passing, but here we're going to kind of look at it a little bit deeper. I'm bringing this up as a criticism of naturalism because neuroscience right now is a very hot field of research, and so is the field of philosophy of mind. And advances in neuroscience and neurophysiology have really been interesting and intriguing for philosophers of mind who study what we call dualism, that the mind is separate from the body or separate from the brain, or that Christians will call it the soul, that the soul is separate from the brain, and they're two different things. And so when philosophers get a hold of research and results from neuroscience, and when neuroscience talk to philosophers, there's some really exciting dialogue happening between those two. And so they use each other's scholarly work in representing their view and their own scholarship. So the science will use the philosopher of mind's work, and the philosopher of minds will use the scientists, the neuroscientists' work. And so right now, these are kind of really hot fields in each respective discipline. And so it's really cool that we're talking about this because A lot of times when we think of scientific apologetics, we think of evolution and creation, or we think of Big Bang cosmology, or God created the earth, you know, 6,000 years ago, that sort of stuff. But we don't really think about the mind-brain interaction, which is a very intriguing field. And so on the theist, or the substance dualist worldview, basically just meaning that the mind is a substance and the brain is a substance. The mind is an immaterial substance and the brain is a material. So when you hear substance, don't just think a material thing. Yes, sir? We're on page 17. And then we are, we're saying that on the theist view, worldview, substance dualism, the mind possesses mental properties and the brain possesses physical properties. So substance dualism says the mind has mental properties, thoughts, feelings, this sort of stuff. Whereas the brain has physical properties that's different from mental properties. Okay? So brain, physical, mind, mental. But on the naturalist view, the brain has both mental and physical. So if you think about it, if you think of brain, let's say, this brain has mental and physical. And this is the naturalist perspective. Whereas the dualist says that the mind and the brain, we'll call this mind over here, and brain, this is a physical property, and this is mental. And this thing's wobbling, so I apologize for my bad handwriting here. This is kind of moving back and forth. And so this is kind of the difference. And I'm pointing that out clearly here because what is happening is that when the dualist or the philosopher of mind studies the mind-brain interaction, we can see how naturalism becomes false. So that we're going to get into this. So the letter C, the philosophers of mind argue either for or against the view that the mind is the same thing as the brain. So if you're a philosopher of mind, you're going to say the mind and the brain are the same thing. Or if you're a philosopher of mind, you're going to say no, they're different things. Now, D, if the mind exists, that blank should be mind, as separate from the brain, then naturalism is false. If you have this perspective, then naturalism is false because you have something that exists that naturalism doesn't account for. Naturalism says that these things are impossible because it's not physical. Now, E, the brain is not identical to mind if one thing is true of mind that is not true of the brain. Okay, so what do I mean by that? This is referred to as the philosopher Leibniz's law of identity of indiscernibles, which is just a big bunch of words for this idea that if two things are identical, you can erase the S there, they share the same properties and everything that is said of one could be said of the other. Okay, so as an example, if you have Clark Kent and Superman, you have essentially the same person. How do we know that? Well, Clark Kent, he dresses up, he wears glasses, suits, and such. Superman dresses up and wears capes and colors, tight outfits and such. And if I'm saying that if you strip away all those clothes and you just look at the person, Clark Kent and Superman, and you say, what could be said of Clark Kent that is true? And what could be said of Superman that is true? Is there anything that can't be said of Clark Kent that can be said of Superman? And vice versa. So if I have Superman, I can say a few things. He gets freaked out around kryptonite. He's a little introspective, kind of in his own thoughts, kind of introverted a little. And he seems to stare at Lois Lane a little bit too long. And if I think about Clark Kent, I can say the same exact things. He gets freaked out about around kryptonite. He stares at Lois Lane too long, and he's a little introspective. And what I'm saying here is that there's a group of properties, a set, as philosophers would say, of properties, say A, B, C, that Clark Kent has, that Superman also has. So I'm going to say something like this. And this goes out to whatever. We'll call it X, Y, Z. Okay? And these are all the properties that define Clark Kent and or describe Clark Kent and describe Superman. All of them. We can put numbers or letters to them. If I find a property that is true of Clark Kent that is not true of Superman, let's call it AA. This is true of Superman, but is not true of Clark Kent. Then I could say that these two things are not the same. They're not identical. There's a difference between them. But if I can't find anything that is true, if there's nothing out here that is true of Superman that's not true of Clark Kent, then I can say that they're the same. Because they share the same properties. And nothing that could be said of Superman can be said of Clark Kent, and vice versa. So this is known as the law of identity of indiscernibles. Now, let's turn the page. If one, let's call one Superman, has a property that two, let's say Clark Kent is two, doesn't have, then they are not the same thing, which is what I'm trying to say. Another example, Ryan. Ryan's not here tonight, so let's use Chris. Chris is 7 feet tall, let's say. He has property A, B, and C. He also weighs 250 pounds, and that is 100% muscle with 0% body fat. This is Chris right here in our class, everyone. Ladies and gentlemen, world's record holder for bench press. And he also has property X, Y, and Z. Now, Chris, we could, if someone is describing, if I'm having a conversation, hey, do you know Chris? Oh, yeah, you know, he's really buff. And he's huge. He could lift a truck, you know. And we start trying to describe Chris, and I give my description, and he gives his description, and he says, well, Chris is 7 feet tall. He has property A, B, and C. He weighs 250 pounds, but he's 99% muscle with 1% body fat. Eesh, not that great, Chris. And X, Y, and Z. So there's something that's said of his description of Chris that's different than my description. And what I'm saying with this is that if I could find one thing true of mind that is not true of brain, then I can say, I can succeed in showing that these two are non-identical entities. Okay, it's pretty simplistic, but we're spelling it out because it's important. That is, if the mind has property X that the brain doesn't have, then the brain is not the mind is not the same thing as the brain. Okay. That's the idea with this critique or criticism. Now, if we get into it a little bit more, we can spell all this out. So note that causation, correlation, and connection between mental states, we'll call those these things, and brain states, we'll call that right there. These, again, this is the fill in the blanks, mental states and brain states, these things is not identicality. So just because you have causation, correlation, and connection between these two doesn't mean you have identicality between these two. Okay, here's the connection, correlation, causality. That does not mean that these two things are identical. Now, I can spell all this out in great detail. I don't want to camp out here on this topic tonight because we can, but there's just probably more things that I want to prioritize. So we're going to quickly move through this. And I'm just going to tell you point three right here is that we have overwhelming evidence that interaction occurs. interaction between the mind and the brain. So with all the research and with all the studies that have been done, we have a lot of interaction between these two things. We know that this thing, this B, affects M, and we know that M affects B. So if I wake up feeling nasty because I only got 3 hours of sleep, I'm going to probably be depressed that day. I'm going to feel some sense of depression. Not crazy. I may not need to go see a psychiatrist, but I'm going to have a little bit of depression that day. And that happens because my physical body is affecting my mind, and that affects my feelings. If I have, my girlfriend breaks up with me, let's just say I'm dating, my girlfriend breaks up with me, I am probably going to have a lack of an appetite. I'm not going to sleep well. I'm going to be feeling, maybe I can be more prone to getting sick. And so my body's affected. So this interaction is kind of this idea that correlation, causality, and connection are happening. But again, it doesn't mean that these two are identical. Okay, so we'll keep moving here. And then go down to J, and you could read this on your own time, page 19, J. These are the properties that mental states have that brain states do not have. So I'm going to describe a few properties that mental states have that brain states don't have. One, non-physical. So a mental state is non-physical. Let me just erase some of this stuff. And two, they present themselves. They present themselves. Okay? Directly to the observer. And what I mean by that is that one is directly aware of his own mental states. No one needs to sit there and describe it to them. We just know what our mental states are. So they have the property of being non-physical. They present themselves directly to the observer. And then turn the page. The three is incorrigibility. Incorrigibility. Something like that, I think is the right spelling. And that just means they cannot be mistaken. Mental states cannot be mistaken. I can't be wrong about the state of my mind because I'm directly aware of it and it's undeniable. I spell this out here quickly. I'm having an experience of Maya in the first row. Okay, I'm experiencing her, I'm seeing her, I'm having sense awareness of her, and this is a mental state. I'm having a mental state of Maya. And I'm experiencing, I'm calling it chair in this outline, and I can't be mistaken about Maya. I can be mistaken about her, but I can't be mistaken about my experience of her. In other words, I can describe Maya wrongly, but I can't describe my mental state wrongly. It's incorrigible. I can't be mistaken about the sensation. And so incorrigibility, and like the other two I just mentioned, are true of mental states that aren't true of brain states. So we had one, two, and four. Intentionality is a property that mental states have that brain states don't have. So one, two, three, and four. In other words, mental states, four, are intentional. They're of or about something. Okay, the chair is not of or about anything. It's just a physical thing. But a mental state, or a thought, you can call a mental state a thought, is of or about something. I'm having a thought about the grass, or I'm having a thought about billiard balls. And so they have this property of being of, or having ofness, or aboutness. I'm having a mental state that has the properties of intentionality, which has the properties ofness or about aboutness. So my thought is of or about something. And every thought is of or about something. And ofness and aboutness are things that can't be explained by science. This is something that just science just doesn't speak to us about, as well as a bunch of other things. But ofness and aboutness are true of mental states. And this is how we can describe mental states or properties of mental states that are not true of brain states. Okay, and that's what I'm saying there in K on page 21. And to sum this all up in L, therefore, the mind has mental states that are not identical to brain states. These properties are true of mental states, but they're not also true of physical states. So that whole idea of the Leibniz law of identity of indiscernibles works with this scenario. Yes, sir. Okay, yes, so, right, so physical states, neuroscience can test the neurons firing in the brain, right? We can kind of see things happening, activity, we could take MRIs of our brains, CAT scans, EEGs, stuff like that. I think EEGs. And so we can now describe the physical state of the mind. We can describe the neurons and the happenings, the chemicals, electrochemical signals. Those would be physical states, not mental. So I can say physical states have these, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 properties to them that aren't true of mental states. Does that help?
Yeah. That's because what you're saying is there's a divide there that science is not, it's explicitly not driven.
Yeah. Okay. That's, yeah. Yes, sir. So artificial intelligence actually is a good example of this, the software
and the hardware.
Now, it's interesting that you brought that up, because when you get to the depths of philosophy of mind, you actually hear these arguments, and they're called software arguments. So there's a couple, two of them, that I know of that are called software arguments that... I can't remember them all right now, but they kind of present the same idea. Because the naturalist will...
And I didn't mean to derail.
Yeah, no, actually, it's good. The naturalist is not going to say, okay, Jeremy, you're right. Mental states are not physical states. You win. Naturalism sucks. I reject it. They don't do that. They respond. And how they do, and what they respond with is... something that clarifies or tries to connect, we'll call the physical states A, B, C, and D. And what the naturalist says is that A, B, C, and D are the same as 1, 2, 3, and 4. You know, that sort of thing. This is what they're trying to do. And it's interesting because Richard Swinburne, who's a British philosopher of mind, who's 70-ish and just been around the block, and he takes on that response by the naturalist, and he says that there's no way the naturalist will ever succeed, not just now, but ever, in saying that brain states are going to be the same as mental states. Because he says that whenever a neuroscientist is performing an experiment on a subject, a patient, he has to ask the patient, did I move your hand or did you move your hand when I stimulated your brain with an electric shock or signal? He always has to get first-person information from the subject. And that goes back to these properties here that can't be said of physical states. I can't recall it offhand, but it's really interesting. All of this stuff is really intriguing.
Because a computer, you don't have to ask. But you don't have, if you had like a computer, and it was, you wouldn't have to ask it, did I move your hand or did you?
Yeah.
You would just take its entire data, dump it, and analyze it, and figure out if it was input or was it output. If there's only two types of data.
Yeah, I think you're getting into that, but I can't recall it offhand.
I was just curious with the software.
Yeah, I can't recall it offhand. Sorry. Yes, sir.
The physical and mental are completely separate. How would you explain the heritability of personality trait?
Yeah. Okay. So, right. So, how does if I have genes, if I'm a parent, and my genes produce a person that is got my same personality, or half my personality, half my wife's, or something. And then I can say these genes are helping produce personality. Well, that is true, but again, these personality traits could, that's maybe something that could be said of brain states and mental states, but they don't have these four properties. The mental states still don't have these four properties. So it doesn't really relate to that, but it's a good point. And what you're getting at is interesting, how the body is affecting the mind. And that's what we've said already. The body affects the mind, and the mind affects the body. And so interaction, correlation, connection, causality does not imply identicality. That's the position. That's the argument. And what Richard Swinburne is saying is that whenever you have... whenever you're trying to understand how mental states and physical states could be the same, you're always going to say that they're different because you're looking for one moving the other. You're looking for interaction, cause and effect. And what that implies by definition is that they're different. They're different entities. So that's kind of the whole... I'm trying to keep it basic because... this is not a philosophy of mind class, which we can do a whole semester on this. I can't teach it, but the experts can. And so it's quite intriguing. All right. Was there another hand or no? Okay. Yeah, I mean, because this is a big topic. But I only wanted to spend 5 minutes on it. See what happens? We got a half an hour on it. Now, I'm not going to talk about that side note under M. The Christian worldview accounts for, and I'm just saying this to you, it's not there. The Christian worldview accounts for and makes sense of mind, whereas the naturalist worldview doesn't. And so the argument is that naturalism should be rejected because the mind exists separate from the brain. And we can know the mind exists separate from the brain because of this, of these mental states that are different than physical states. These things cannot be said of physical states, but they can be said of mental states. And so, again, the Christian worldview says, oh yeah, we've got mind. It's called the soul. We know how to talk about mind. It's in our whole worldview. And so the Christian worldview makes sense of mind, whereas naturalism doesn't. Now, we're going to get into this next one. I think we've gotten all the questions on that. Yes or no? Was there any other questions? Okay, naturalism is self-refuting. We've talked a little bit about how scientism is self-refuting. Naturalism is self-refuting. This is J.P. Moreland's self-refuting argument. And on the next page, I have a quote from him, but we don't have to read that. Item two, I'm just going to explain what this is. if there is, in fact, nothing but matter in motion, okay, the blank is just matter, the words matter and motion, if there's, in fact, nothing but matter in motion in the world, then naturalism is true. So, yeah, if things are just banging against other things and stuff is moving stuff, then sure, naturalism's true. No problem. So let's grant that thesis. Now, this is the state of affairs, or this state of affairs denies the possibility of rationality, as there are no minds in the world to know naturalism is true. So in other words, if I'm saying that naturalism is true, and naturalism denies the possibility of rationality or thinking, then no one could say that they know naturalism is true. So if I'm a person that holds to naturalism, I hold it, but I don't know it's true. Oh, let's explain. So this is so because naturalism denies the preconditions for rationality. So in order for someone to have rationality, in order for someone to be a rational person and to think logically and to think rationally about things and not irrationally, I need to have these preconditions. I need to have self-awareness, an A, to be aware of our thoughts. Okay, so if I'm going to be if I say I'm a thinker and I think, I better have self-awareness. I better know that I'm thinking. B, thoughts with intentionality. We talked about that. It needs to be of or about something. Or this is just part of the whole rational enterprise. When someone says I'm rational, this is what they're saying. This is what they're assuming to be the case. The preconditions. These things must be here for rationality to occur. C, reasons, propositions, thoughts, evidence, and logic. In order for us to have rationality, then I need to have reasons, propositions, thoughts, evidence, and logic. For instance, the relation of premises prescribes what one ought to rationally accept, but physical states cannot logically imply, infer, or prescribe the rational ought in a logical flow of thought. So in other words, if I have an argument, if you go back to, say, Aristotle or something, premise A, all apples are purple, let's say. Premise B, all purple things are extremely evil. Therefore, conclusion, all apples are extremely evil. Okay, if these two premises are true, the conclusion necessarily follows. It has to follow. This is just pure basic logic from 2,500 years ago. Now, obviously, these are not true, but what is said here is that the relationship between these premises prescribes what one rationally ought to accept. If these are true, one rationally ought to accept this conclusion. If you don't, that's irrational. That's an irrational thought process. Now, what naturalism, or let me rephrase, this is, again, part of the preconditions for rationality, that logic, thought processes are necessary. If they're not necessary, there's no rationality, because rationality is necessary for someone to derive or arrive at a conclusion. Logical connections are not physical. In two there. And D, a rational faculty capable of rational insight to see a result of the argument. That's another precondition for rationality. One has to have a mind. We'll call it rational faculty, because we don't want to necessarily say mind at this point. We're just saying rational faculty. You have to have rational faculty to see this argument and say, yeah, I see it, I understand it, that's an argument, and I'm there to observe it and think about it. And then item E, a precondition for rationality is I need to be an enduring I. That little quotes there is I, the letter I. An enduring I. I need to endure, to be present, to connect a series of thoughts, A, B, and C, rationally. I need to be here. Me, Jeremy, I need to be able to be here from time one to time two to think through this and flow from premise to premise in a rational argument. That is, the I does not morph or come in and out of existence. So if I'm reading premise A and all of a sudden I disappear, go into a parallel universe, and someone reads premise B and I come back at premise C, then I'm not here. I'm not enduring through this time to see it. So enduring I is necessary for rationality. And then F, agent self, with free will to deliberate, choose, and act according to a rational decision. So suppose someone tells me this argument, and I'm thinking about it, and I'm here for the whole thing, I need to be able to choose that this is a good argument. It makes sense. And I can't be forced into it. If someone says, here's a terrible argument, accept it, and I do because I have to, then I'm not making a decision by deliberation, by saying, is this true? Do I agree? Do I assent to this truth? So I need to be free. I need to have free will to make a rational decision. So the freedom to believe and ability to believe something is true based on good reasons. That's what I need to have. The freedom to and ability to believe something is true based on good reasons. Okay? Now, these are the preconditions for rationality. In order for rationality for any person on the planet, you have to have this sort of stuff present. Now, if one claims to know, you could circle the word know, that's underlined, that naturalism is true, or to embrace it for good reasons, you could circle good reasons, or to recommend it, you could circle recommend it, or to recommend naturalism to others due to, say, evidence of naturalism, then this is self-refuting. So if I'm a naturalist and I say, I know naturalism is true, or if I say, I hold to naturalism because I have good reasons, and you list out your reasons, or I recommend naturalism to you as a worldview, I'm actually self-refuting. I'm self-defeating. Because this knowing, thinking, etc. uses a mind. It uses rationality. Rationality could only occur if these preconditions are met. And what I'm saying, or what the argument JP is, Dr. Moreland is saying, is that naturalism denies the preconditions of rationality. So a mind is not capable of knowing and saying I have good reasons and recommending naturalism. So naturalism is self-refuting. And in another sense, it's self-refuting. It is also self-refuting because naturalism implies determinism. Determinism is just part of the whole worldview of naturalism. But determinism rejects free will. So one would be contradicting himself if he claims that he chooses to hold to determinism because that is choosing a view which says you cannot choose. Thus, it is self-refuting to claim this rational choice to hold to naturalism because this rational, you could put the word choice, this rational choice is impossible in determinism or in naturalism. Like I just said, for the agent self and F, that's the preconditions for rationality. So what this is saying is that it's also self-refuting in the respect that determinism is implied in naturalism, and that if something is predetermined, it can't have free will. It's predetermined to do something and it cannot choose otherwise. And so no one could say, I'm choosing the naturalist position because it's a good position to hold to. I choose it. No one could say that because choosing is impossible in naturalism. And again, this idea is self-refuting. So if you're a naturalist, one could say that you didn't choose that position rationally. You were forced to be a naturalist you had no choice, and you never accepted a rational argument for your position. Now, to finalize this, we could say, thus, knowing, thinking, and choosing to believe that naturalism is true is self-defeating. Self-defeating. Now, I didn't give you this material, but I'm just going to say it gets a little worse if someone holds to naturalism. And I'll just kind of go over this. You don't have it there. But another philosopher of mind, John Lennox, another British guy, he says, if we developed from the material of the universe, our brains are simply material with electrochemical neural events. And if that's true, like naturalism says, then it's just a bunch of matter in motion. And we cannot trust matter in motion to describe to us reality correctly. It's just a bunch of stuff hitting each other and moving, and things are just happening. And he goes further in this, and he says that even the advocate of naturalism and the Christian and the Buddhist and the scientist, all of us, everybody on the planet, is just spattering off noises. When we talk, we're just making noises. It's just the result of synapses receiving electrochemical signals in our brains that is forcing words to come out of our mouths. And those words are basically meaningless because the matter in motion is just random because it's just things banging against each other. And so nothing that is said on this planet, whether you're a naturalist, Christian, scientist, Buddhist, whatever, nothing is said of that has any meaning because the naturalist, Christian, Buddhist, scientist, we're all just making noises. If something of meaning was actually said, if someone said something that made sense, like the Lord is everlasting, or the Lord everlasting, no one could even know what that means. Because the random processes in our head that is trying to interpret it, or may not even be trying to, is just firing a bunch of stuff. It's just stuff moving stuff. And no one could even recognize the meaning of the noises that people are saying. So according to this view, the naturalist cannot think and definitely cannot have a rational discussion about coherent ideas. This is what John Lennox is saying, is that if someone says these words, that they're just making noises because their brain is just moving stuff. And when the naturalist says that we ought to be naturalists in our worldview, or he holds to naturalism for good reasons, he's also just making noises and saying stuff. So why should we hold to his position? Because that position is not a trustworthy position. It's just based on random matter in motion that can't be trusted. Now, this is what John Lennox says and how he explains how this view is self-refuting. And to me, both of those criticisms make sense. And so I present them here. One is maybe stronger than the other, but they're, in my opinion, pretty daunting. Now, there is a final... does anyone have any questions on that before we get into this? We're actually not going to cover this last one. We're going to take a break, and then we're going to skip this last one. But I want to summarize this whole section of the problems of naturalism and scientism. Does anyone have any questions about this idea that Moreland and Lennox presents? Yes, sir. Say that last part. It sounds like what you're describing is that this view of naturalism that says that man is just the result of this universe of matter and motion, and eventually man was produced, and eventually consciousness was produced out of that. And the universe then is said to give birth to consciousness eventually over billions of years. Is that what you're getting at?
Yeah,
Okay, that's a different thing. Very, very different.
Consciousness has some form of consciousness, and then we are a byproduct of that. I've just heard that argument, so is that related?
Okay, so there's some sort of mental divine being out of particles in motion that emerges, and then that created man? Okay. I'm not too sure if many people hold to that position, so I won't respond to it here, but it's an interesting thought position to hold to. Any other questions on the self-refuting stuff? Okay, well, let's take a break, but let me say these few last statements, and then we'll move into the next section after the break. Out of the two main alternatives, we're on page 25 at the bottom. So I'm concluding this portion that says that naturalism, it has problems and ought to be rejected. Two main alternatives, naturalism and theism, these are the general alternatives. Perhaps one could say that there's a spectrum of other minor views in the middle, ranging from deism to New Age, pantheism to panentheism to whatever. But in general, you kind of have these two main views, especially in the Western world, that naturalism and theism. Quantum physicist, we're on 26, quantum physicist John Polkinghorne explains that we all start with certain metaphysical presuppositions, no matter who we are. This is what he says. We start with this idea of the existence of matter or the existence of God. It or he just exists without the other. Matter exists without God, which is what we could think of as naturalism, or God exists without matter. We could call it supernaturalism. So one exists without the other. These are kind of the ideas with these worldviews. And out of these two main alternatives, we can now easily see that naturalism is to be rejected based on these 10 criticisms. And I didn't give you the 10th one because it's a little bit rigorous. You could read it on your own time and spend time with it because it's a little challenging. Polkinghorne says, the materialist starting point is unsatisfactory because the laws of nature have a character which is not self-contained but point beyond themselves to deeper intelligibility in the universe. This will be seen more clearly as we see evidence for intelligent design in the next sections. Now, so what I've done is I've tried to look at naturalism in general and how naturalism makes sense of our world as a worldview or a philosophy of science, you could say. And I've tried to show that there are criticisms and legitimate problems with naturalism, and that's why it ought to be rejected. Not just because I don't like naturalism, not because naturalism hurt my feelings, it's just because, to me, naturalism has rational problems that I cannot ascribe to. So what about theism? What about the theistic worldview? So at this point, we can see that at least the theistic worldview has these benefits that naturalism doesn't. It explains the features of human existence and the world. It explains things like the mind, for instance, features of a human existence, like we talked about thoughts, numbers, justice, love. The theistic worldview explains those things, where they came from. And the world, without the problems that naturalism is plagued with, as we've seen above in the last couple hours of class. And the other benefit that theism has that naturalism doesn't, it's not self-refuting like these things are, empiricism, scientism, naturalism. So in this respect, we've seen that theism doesn't have the same problems. And that's all I'm saying at this point. I'm not saying that theism is good or Christianity is good. All I'm trying to say so far is that naturalism has problems, and now we need to understand theism and evaluate Christianity on its own merits. How does Christianity or theism explain the world to us correctly? Does it explain it correctly? And if so, how does it do that? Does it fail like naturalism seems to have failed? Does it have similar problems? We'll have to look at that now in its own right. And so with that, we'll just take a break. Come back. There's some refreshments in the back. Coffee is in the back. And feel free to chat. Thanks. Okay. Yeah, so we're on item three down there. History, it is best to know the history of science to know science. And what I mean by that is, as quantum physicist John Polkinghorne, he says, actual history of science is the best way to create a philosophy of science. So throughout history, we have seen the failures and the breakthroughs in science. Historically speaking, science, as well as theology, has been shown to progress with theory and experiment, lulls and confusion, mistakes and redirections based on political, religious, social, cultural influences. So if the experience of science teaches anything, it is that the world is very strange and surprising, and many revolutions in science have certainly shown us that. So all this is saying is that through history, when we look at history, we see the field of science going through ups and downs and progress, and then times where there's not that much progress, and then lots of progress, and then things that were once held dear were then rejected later, just like theology, for instance. And so this is the best way to know science, what science is a field, when someone's trying to figure out what science is. And then if we look at the practice of science, what actually happens in science? The actual practice of science is very collaborative. It's collaborative in the sense that both evidence and theory are equally important. Science requires a combination of theory and experiment, interpretation, and observing again. And these are just real basic ideas of science. We don't have to go through all these different quotes, but one thing to keep in mind is that all quests for truth in the hermeneutical, interpretative circle of investigation and judgment, or all quests for truth are in this circle of investigation and judgment. So science takes judgment to gain reliable knowledge. It takes judgment. It's not all just cold, hard facts slapping us in the face. And so what I mean is that when we do an experiment or we make some observations, we're not just sitting there being like, slapped in the face by evidence. There's a human being that is looking at it, and he's judging this evidence. He's interpreting it. And it may just be writing it down. It may just be simple stuff. But then from those results, we can make theories and judge the results, whether they're good or bad or done correctly or whether we need more, and so forth. One must understand his own presuppositions, but have flexible presuppositions when interpreting empirical observations. Meaning that when we approach empirical observations, we all approach them with some level of assumption, some level of presupposition. And in our history, who we are, what we are, where we came from, kind of influences us when we make judgments sometimes. So we just need to be aware of our presuppositions. For instance, if I'm someone who says that the god Ra causes when I drop something to understand gravity, I think that the god Ra causes it to go down like this, you know, in some strange swirly line formation. And I see that it doesn't do that when I drop it. But other effects are causing the thing to move and change shape as it drops. And so what I could say is that, well, maybe my sun god, Ra, theory was wrong. It does move around, but it doesn't move around like that. So I'm coming to the table with certain presuppositions, is all I'm saying. Many of us have crazy ones like that, or some of us do, and some of us don't. But and a lot of times, our presuppositions are pretty minimal, but we all have them. And so Polkinghorne and others suggest that just being aware of these things is helpful. Just be aware of them. What do you expect? What do you presuppose is going to occur? And that's part of science, but we don't want to cause it to... we don't want to allow those presuppositions to cause the interpretations to be wrong. To misinterpret something. One must use common sense principles when interpreting empirical observations, and for Polkinghorne, interpretation in science and theology is to be performed with critical realism rather than mere speculation. and we could skip that quote. And basically meaning that in actuality, when we put all this together, science progresses with experiment and interpretation. That's all I'm saying. At the end of the day, you both need experiment and experiential data and theory. And this is pretty intuitive, but some of us just need to kind of be reminded of these things, because it's, even though we think science is this field where it's just crude, hard facts, pure hard facts, simple, blah, 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 it just is what it is. That's not always the case when we do science. Overall, history and practice show the best way to view science, whereas the worldviews of naturalism, empiricism, and scientism are not necessary. Thus, alternative views of science are more realistic and favorable than those seen in naturalism and scientism. So what I'm saying is that naturalism and scientism aren't very helpful in helping us understand science as a discipline like the history and practice of science are. When we look at the history and practice of science, we can understand science better than what naturalism and scientism teach us. Okay, and then the last point under this premise one is that good models for secular and Christian scientists can be maintained without naturalism and scientism. So when we think about scientists like Stephen Hawking, Charles Darwin, and Stephen Meyer, we can say and see that they offer good models for a scientist of any background, Christian, Buddhist, Muslim, non-religious, without the need of naturalism and scientism. And you're probably sick of me describing naturalism and scientism, but I'm doing that for a reason, because when we get into the Christian worldview and understand, and when we look at science stuff and we want to understand Christianity, well, we can say, wait a minute, it's not what I'm used to hearing. And I'm trying to explain that maybe what we're used to hearing in this naturalism and scientistic worldview and world we live in may not be a good position. Now, eminent secular cosmologist Stephen Hawking, many have heard that name, I'm sure, he proposes that a scientific model is a good model if it is A, elegant, B, contains few arbitrary or adjustable elements, meaning that it doesn't have a lot of fudge factors or adjustment factors, which would turn the model into a more of a record of behavior. In other words, if I'm looking at a flight path and I'm trying to describe it in terms of a formula, and I'm having to put all these adjustment factors and other things that create this huge equation, then I'm kind of forcing it, and it's not really a good model, is what he's saying. Too many of that doesn't describe reality correctly, he says. And C, it agrees with and explains all kinds of existing observations. All of it. So a good model will explain everything. And D, it makes detailed predictions about future observations that can falsify the model if the predictions do not match future observations. So if I'm saying, here's a model of reality, and it says XYZ, and if you do this experiment ABC, you're going to get these sorts of results. And so a model will predict future observations, is what he says. And in that sense, on the next page, the model can be falsified and be disproved. And again, I'm saying that naturalism, scientism are nowhere to be found in Stephen Hawking's model. There's nothing that implies naturalism or scientism based on a good model of science. And again, Stephen Hawking is like the most eminent, you know, cosmologist out there today, I guess, very well known. Now, if you cruise down to part five, skip that whole chunk, this is just more elaboration on Hawking's approach. We'll just skip that for now because it's interesting but not necessary. Microbiologist Stephen Meyer proposes using Charles Darwin's and Charles Lyell's 19th century geologist approach. So this is 200 years ago. These guys were around. Charles Lyell was a famous geologist who helped us understand the age of the Earth through looking at geology before Darwin wrote his book. And so they're saying that you posit a cause which is known from our present experience to explain the data of the past. So you just come up with some cause that we would consider reasonable when looking at present phenomena, and you could say that this is helpful in describing the past too. And this idea is known as uniformitarianism, that the present is consistent with the past and the future. That nature is uniform in general. That's what that's just saying. So again, B, you generate a bunch of possible causes based on present knowledge of cause and effect of such similar events. You gather a bunch of possible causes to help explain the data. And second, you infer the most likely cause of several possible causes. You make an inference to the most likely cause of all these several possible causes that you generated to help explain the phenomena. So Darwin used what's called inference to the best explanation in defending his theory. He established this question: how can I best explain the observations? What best explains these observations? He used inference to the best explanation for his theory of natural selection based on random mutations and so forth. Now, according to Meyer, who's living today, he says this inference approach by scientists helped answer this philosophical question of how to develop a theory. So philosophers like to philosophize about all sorts of stuff, and they say, well, how do we even develop a theory? How does one go about that? And they go off and write volumes of philosophy on this. And so Meyer is saying, well, the scientists actually helped the philosophers answer that question because they were doing so such and such, and now philosophers called it inference to the best explanation. But scientists were just using that type of philosophy unknowingly, that type of thinking, that type of rationality. Now, interestingly, intelligent design uses the same inference to the best explanation as Darwin did. Now, that may come across as shocking, that intelligent design has something in common with Darwin, but it's true. Now, whether you like intelligent design or you hate it or you think it's rubbish or you praise it, whatever, all I'm saying right now is that it uses this idea of inference to the best explanation. That's what they're doing when they're making an inference. It doesn't mean I'm saying they're right or wrong. I'm just saying this is what they're doing. And in fact, all they're doing is what Darwin did. So if you love Darwin, you think he's like, you know, close to Jesus or something, that's cool. Well, these guys think that Darwin had an interesting approach, and that's what they're doing, these intelligent design people. So, that's the end of this little outline. Are there any questions on that? Well, let's go ahead. Maybe, Tiffany, can you help me pass this extra outline out? We have about 15 more minutes of class time. Why she's doing that, are there any questions? Yes, sir, in the back. Yeah. Yeah, right. I didn't want to go there until the end of the class. It's a great question. I knew someone was going to ask that.
Is that why we get the handouts like in little sections? Little thing? You can't read ahead. Who did it?
I'm guessing because you have two Dr. Ross books, but then again, you have one Anthony Ross book, right? So I'm like,
what is he? I also have a bunch of I have Hawking's book too. So, but you know what? I'll save the answer to that. Leave people hanging. I don't know if I can, but we'll see. Because actually, I can't. I have to rent a car. I have to take it back. But anyway, at the end of the class, like we talked about before in the first class, we're going to look at the different views of Christianity and how they relate to the age of the earth. Any other questions? Okay, we'll move in. Any other questions? Yes, sir.
In bringing up Darwin, were you trying to suggest that when you reject evolution?
Me? That I reject evolution? Or he rejects evolution?
You.
That I reject evolution? Yeah, I'm also... Yeah, I mean, all I was just saying, I'm not going to answer that right now, like his question, because I don't want to give away all these things. But I'm going to share that later, my position on it. But all I was just saying was that Darwin uses this type of thinking called inference to the best explanation. Okay, in this outline. We are now on the second premise in this big line of thought for this class, and the second topic. This topic will be much shorter than the first one. It's only 14 pages. But then when we get to the third premise or third topic, it'll be much longer. And that'll be really the heart of the class. So if you're really excited and waiting for some really good science stuff, and like looking at like hard evidence sorts of things and getting deep into astrophysics and microbiology and stuff like that, we're going to get there, probably starting next week, I believe. So, but this week and a little bit next week, we're going to go through these 14 pages, and then we'll get into that stuff. All right, so science and Christianity are not in conflict, but are better understood as integrated sources of knowledge. Okay, so that's my premise. That is not necessarily just mine. I'm just, again, all of these arguments I'm presenting are these premises, are things I'm gathering together that aren't really mine. I'm just kind of helping summarize and compile a bunch of lines of reasoning that you'll get when you read scientific apologetic stuff. Okay, so the views of Christianity. The views of science and Christianity. There's the conflict view, there's the independent view, there's the dialogue view, and there's the integration view. So when we look at the several different views of science and Christianity, what we find is that the breakdown of each view in line one there shows that the integration view is realistic and favorable. So what I'm saying in this argument is that the integration view of these four views is realistic and favorable, whereas the other ones have their may have their merits, but aren't as realistic and favorable as the integration view. And so that's what we're gonna present here. Now, here are the four basic views on the relationship between science and religion. And this is these views are not mine. These views are extractions, if you will, from pop culture and academia. Okay, usually if you've thought about some of this stuff at all or barely thought about it, you're going to have one of these views or perhaps somewhere in between. But this is what I'm trying to present is the full spectrum of views across pop culture and academia. Okay, so if you think about the left-hand side one, the conflict one, that's what we're going to look at first. The conflict view. This is the most common perception of our day. It's the alleged battle between scientific materialism and biblical literalism. This view poses that these two see themselves as the path to true knowledge at the expense of the other, religion, labeled subjective, or science, which could be labeled a conspiracy to prove atheism. Okay, these are the labels that the others are said to put on the other. This is a one or the other, either or, extremist view. The media likes the conflict view and promotes it as it, media, is biased to the side of science. So again, this is the idea that scientific materialism and biblical literalism are at complete odds with each other. This is the view some people hold, which is very, very common in our society, that these things are bad. Each one says that one's bad, and this one says that one's bad. Not terribly bad, like evil, but not good to hold to. Now, this is the view that Richard Dawkins and others seem to espouse when they talk and do debates. This view seems to be the most popular, but is completely unhistorical in terms of what actually is happening with science and religion in that relationship. The history of science and religion reveals that science and Christianity have been anything but conflicting. When we examine history, Christianity has provided the unified concept of a creator and an understanding of a stable universe for science to have a foundation. And this is a well-documented cultural and academic scene in Europe for well over 1,500 years. In other words, Christianity set the stage for science to emerge. Now, this is not just me becoming a historian, but this is debatable, and I'm painting with a broad brush here when I'm talking about history. But most historians of science and cultural historians agree that Christianity laid a foundation, philosophically speaking, in medieval Europe for the rise of modern science. And again, this is against this idea that science is against Christianity. Now, as a side note, a cultural critic, Dr. Oz Guinness, he happened to be raised in China, he recognized the comparatively minor Chinese scientific developments during the same era, meaning during the same last couple hundred years. And interestingly, Chinese anthropologists have researched Chinese culture and tried to understand what was the reason for their scientific industrial revolution delay. And they found that the anthropological reason was a lack of a unifying concept of God and the laws of nature as Europe had. So in other words, the laws, or this idea that God exists and that there's uniformity in nature, is something that allowed Europe to produce modern scientific theories and developments. And I'm not making this stuff up. People have said this, and it's well documented. Now, the apparent conflict that most people observe in the area of worldview difference between naturalist and the naturalist worldview and the supernatural worldview. And I'm saying refer to the table provided above. I'm just saying that the apparent conflict is between naturalism and supernaturalism. And this is not the same thing there, I'm saying in G, between science as a field of research and Christianity as a religion. So if you recall, on the first night, I passed out a table at the end of the class, and at the table it had naturalism at the top, and it had supernaturalism, and it had a bunch of things. Do you remember that table? And what I'm saying is that this is really the conflict. This is where the conflict lies, between these worldviews. But most people think that the conflict lies between science and religion, where this is not in conflict, but people think it is. So this is the popular opinion, conflict. And this is not even really talked about. Question mark. And what we are trying to do here in this class is make some finer distinctions and saying really what's happening here in pop culture and academia. And so where the conflict is here, not here. And so what I'm saying is that the correct view allows integration. And we're going to get to that, the integration view. Or dialogue, the other view. Now, H, worldviews are not the same as science and Christianity. These things are all different. They're not the same. One could hold to love science and be a Buddhist, or, you know, this sort of stuff. You don't have to be just on this side. Okay, maintaining science versus Christianity is actually committing the logical fallacy of false dilemma, as these are not mutually exclusive, as we will see. The fallacy of false dilemma is just a logical fallacy known in philosophy. It presents two extreme absolute choices when more variation exists. Typically, the two choices are extreme positions of a spectrum of views. So what the fallacy of a false dilemma is something like this. I'll just share this. Someone could say, I thought you were a Christian, but you weren't at church. I thought you were a Christian, but you weren't at church. It's like, hey, I am a Christian. I just didn't go to church. Like, people, you know, could be these Bible thumper Christians that we may have come across in our past who may say this to us. But this is not the full story. There's more to it than that. There's an in-between. I am a Christian. I just didn't go to church because of XYZ. There's another way to think about it. We don't have to deal with these extremes. You know, one is against the other. And Obi-Wan Kenobi says, only a Sith deals in absolutes. So this is just another idea. If you say an absolute statement, a proposition, then you're a Sith. Wait a minute, Obi-Wan Kenobi, you just said an absolute. So what we're dealing with here is these extremes. And what I'm saying is that the conflict view is an extremist view. There's a lot of play in between here that is not expressed when someone says this is against the other. And the point is that more options of the interaction of science and religion exist, and it doesn't have to be one against the other. So again, that's the fallacy of the false dilemma. And overall, this science versus Christianity view is misrepresented and accurate. Now, another way you can think about this, before we move on, and we only have about 5 more minutes, but another way you could quickly think about this is that you have scientific materialism, for instance, over here on this side of the spectrum. And then you have all this variation, and then you have biblical literalism. Can you guys see this stuff over there?
No.
Yeah?
No.
Okay. I don't know if the glare or whatever. So between these worldviews, you have stuff like the belief that there's a higher power. And then you may have this idea of a belief in God, say, Yahweh, the Bible God. Then you have this idea of theistic evolution. And then you have this idea of progressive creation. And I'm not giving away the farm here. We already talked about the stuff on the first class. If you go back to that structure, the second page of that, which it should be in the flap, you have some of the stuff that I'm saying. Then you have this idea of progressive creation. So again, this idea that these things are in conflict with each other doesn't relate to this big middle here group of ideas people have. So again, this conflict view is not an accurate view of the relationship between science and Christianity. It's creating an extremist view. And so that view, I'm saying, is not a good view to hold to. Now, the independence view. The independence view shows a separation, but not war, between empirical human discovery, for instance, and revelation, revealed truth. There's a separation, but not necessarily a war. They're not in conflict. That is, science is limited to natural realms, to the objective, public, and repeatable data, whereas religion is limited to spiritual realms, to order, beauty, and inner life experiences. So the independence view says these things are not war, but these things are just separate. Science deals with facts, for instance. Religion deals with feeling. That sort of approach. As an example of the independence view, this is a quote from the National Academy of Sciences, NAS. They say, science and religion are different ways of understanding. Okay, they hold to this independence view. Needlessly placing them in opposition, like the conflict view, reduces the potential to both contribute to a better future. Well, that's really nice of the National Academy of Sciences to say that religion will contribute to a better future. Well, thank you. That's very kind of you to say that. Overall, this is an example of the independence view. The strange Christian theory may be right, but it is not science. And these two areas of study shouldn't interact, as they are very different. That's kind of what this is saying. This is an example of the independence view. And if you want some good evolutionist propaganda to steer the masses, go to the above referenced document in the footnote, because it's got some really good evolutionist propaganda to steer the masses. They come across harmless, the NAS. But they wrote later in that same document that says that Christianity may, or religion may, promote a better future, they say that both creationism or intelligent design are not science, but are more like astrology and witchcraft. Now, I'm not even arguing for ID at the moment, but astrology and witchcraft, that really doesn't seem to me like it will promote a better future. Sorry. But you, NAS, in item 6, they bash ID and creationism, but then they say there are some religious scientists who agree that evolution is the correct theory, and so it's a little bit of a backhanded compliment, and it's less of a compliment and more of a backhand. So if you are someone who says that ID is like astrology and witchcraft, you're really backhanding that view, actually. And so the NAS does that, but they do it in a way where they say, these things can promote a better future, very nicely. Thank you, but that's not really what you think. So we have to be careful in our dialogue with each other on both sides of the spectrum. We need to respect the other position and really say what it is and what it's not, and do that accurately. Evolutionary biologist Stephen Jay Gould, who has now passed away, he famously referred to this separate but complementary relationship as non-overlapping magisteria. Non-overlapping magisteria. So that became kind of a famous little phrase. And he's just, again, describing this independence view, that these two things are different, they don't overlap, but they're both separate realms of great knowledge. How do science and theology differ? They differ in kind of experience, as subjective experiences cannot be repeated in the same way that experiments can. They differ in terms of the development of theological understanding as a more complex process. This sentence is very poorly written. I have to apologize. I was drunk that night. Just kidding. But if you can cross out the word process, that is the, on the second line, and write in which is different from the. What I'm trying to say is that differ in terms of the development of theological understanding as a more complex process, which is different from the case for scientific understanding. And someone could say that's a more simple process, but it may not be. So someone could say that the development of theology is very complicated, and I think it is. It is very complicated. Whereas science just builds on itself. Science builds on itself. It uses previous understanding, and it develops further understanding. Whereas theologians, in every generation, must dialogue with all of the previous generation of theologians. So if you're a theologian today, you need to read what Aquinas said in 1200, you need to read what Augustine said in 400, you need to read what Calvin and all the theologians say today, and the early church fathers, and Paul, and Peter, and you need to read all of these people in order to do theology well. Because otherwise you may be saying something really bad, like very heretical, and doesn't align with anything biblical. And so people have made these mistakes over time, so theology has to interact with that those ideas. That's why it's a little bit complex. It's complicated because there's a lot of material out there. 2,000 years worth of material for the Christian tradition. And three, these things differ in terms of who is guiding the encounter with truth. God in theology is hopefully guiding the theologian, whereas the scientist in science is the scientist is guiding the science. Again, these are just showing the difference between science and Christianity. They differ in terms of conclusions. The conclusions of science get universal acceptance oftentimes. It depends on the science, I guess. But most of the time, people adhere to it. And conclusions in religion vary from country to country. And these are just observations of what people are experiencing or how they think about these things. I'm not saying that that's good. I'm just saying that this is what seems to happen. And many think that for science and religion, a good boundary makes good neighbors. So it's good that you have boundaries between science and religion and they don't interact with each other. And that's what this view is saying. And you could basically skip that. That's kind of pretty self-explanatory. And go to item four. In practice, it's only science that's in control. Science illuminates the Bible, not the other way around. That's how, when I think about this, I'm saying that science is such a huge enterprise. It seems that that independence view doesn't really happen in actuality. In actuality, science seems to interject into the religious side a little too much, or scientists do, or people who hold to naturalism and scientism do. Like Stephen Jay Gould, he says, scientists can make religious statements. So here we see that it's really hard to keep the two things separate and keep the fine line distinction between science and religion. And Stephen Jay Gould says that scientists can actually make religious statements. And oftentimes we hear Stephen Hawking talking about God or whether there's a God and, you know, making these sorts of statements where he's a scientist and he's considering the beginning of time and things like that. On the other hand, these scientists oftentimes, not all of them, but some of them, dismiss any contrary views, such as intelligent design. So a person like Jonathan Wells, a scientist, he's been now considered suspect, and his text, Icons of Evolution, has been dismissed because of his ID leanings. So scientists tend to kick out the view that is contrary to the generally held view. It's criticized beyond what is normal. That's what I'm trying to say. Criticism's good, but beyond what is normal. So I'm just saying that these things are, it's hard to keep that good boundary between neighbors in practice, is all I'm trying to say.
Are the scientists rejecting objective facts that intelligent design people are putting forth, or are they rejecting interpretations and conjectures?
Right. That's a good question. You know, we're going to spend, I don't mean to not answer this, but I would rather answer your question over the next few weeks, because we're going to spend a lot of time in intelligent design. And so it's a good question, but I prefer just to wait, if that's okay.
Yeah, I personally don't think there's that much debate over a fact. I mean, you know, this is a pair of glasses and everybody sees it. There's no dispute over that.
Yeah.
Interpretation of that might be something else.
Yep. Yeah, thank you. So are boundaries possible? And this view just is looking at the boundaries between them, and it's saying that, are these boundaries realistic? Is this independence view really realistic, or do people try to cross that boundary and go into their neighbor's yard? And I'm just making some statements here under that item F. And then overall, in item G, overall this view is better than the conflict view, but may not be helpful in understanding reality holistically, as it constrains the other position and thus limits its own scope. So that's my criticism of the independence view. It's hard to keep the boundary there. And it constrains the other view, and it constrains its own view when one holds to the independence view. Okay. The dialogue view and the integration view is what we'll get into next week. And we'll just spend a little bit of time at the first half going through the rest of this outline to the 14th page. And then we're going to get into this ID stuff, which is exactly what you just brought up, Mark, I believe. Mark, right? Yeah. So next week, we're actually going to start that in the second half. And we're going to introduce this idea of ID. What is it? And then we're going to start looking at different types of ID, statements and philosophies and things like that. Are there any other questions on this material here? Okay. Let's just go ahead and close in word prayer, and then we'll be dismissed. Dear God, our heart and our intention is to understand reality accurately, and we're trying to do that as best we know how. We're trying to use wisdom and logic and rationality, and we just pray that you would bless us and help us as we go over this stuff, and that you would guide our thinking to help us find your truth and find reality as best as possible and as accurately as possible. We pray that you would reveal yourself to us this week, protect us, guide us, and keep us safe. In Jesus' name, amen. Amen. Thank you.